Judiciary Committee to order. We've got quite a workload this morning, 27, 28 bills that we're going to deal with. A couple will be coming off for a little bit more work that we found out we have to do. I'll explain that when we get to them. I'll open a work session for possible consideration of House Bill 2892.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Folsom.
I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2892.
Representative moves that we suspend the rules for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2892. This is an undebatable motion. Those of the opinion that the rule should be suspended for the purpose of reconsideration of the vote on House Bill 2892 will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk, will call the roll, please.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Ford?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. The rules are suspended.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson.
Reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2892 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves that we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2892 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Those with an opinion that we should reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2892 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye. Those opposed, no.
Representative
Ackerman? Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Ward?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Mr. Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye.
I'll
close the work session on House Bill 2892. We do have a bill. Open the work session on House Bill 2207.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, House Bill 2207 comes to you at the request of the Office of Regulatory Streamlining and the Attorney General's Office. Passed down to the Civil Subcommittee on April 20th. Right now, under current law, administrative rules must be in substantial compliance with procedures provided by statute on the effect or on the date the rule is adopted. House Bill 2207 changes that so that administrative rules must be in substantial compliance with those statutory requirements on the date that the rule is delivered to the Secretary of State for the purpose of publication. We heard testimony that there could be as much as 2 or 3 months between that time that it's delivered to the Secretary of State and the time the rule is adopted. This just allows for some efficiency for these rules. If there is a major rule change during that gap of time, the agency would have to go through the entire process again. So this, in a sense, allows them to not have to go through that process again.
Representative Ackerman?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will move that House Bill 2207 be forwarded to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Ackerman has moved House Bill 2207 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objections, discussions? Call the roll, please.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Ward?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Mr. Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 2207 does move to the floor with a due pass. Representative Ackerman, would you be a carrier, please?
I will, thank you.
Open a work session on House Bill 2221A.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, House Bill 2221A was placed on the consent calendar on April 1st and pulled because of some issues that were raised by certain representatives. These issues have been taken care of, specifically in the -A3 amendments, which were adopted by the Civil Subcommittee. Those amendments restore previously deleted provisions that require the multidisciplinary teams to provide for an independent review of sensitive cases, to clarify who may participate in child abuse medical assessment, and they specifically define a child abuse medical assessment.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move that the -3 amendments to House Bill 2221 be incorporated within the main bill.
Were they adopted in the sub?
Those amendments were adopted in the subcommittee.
They were?
Yes, they were.
Thank you. Okay, then I'll withdraw the motion and move that House Bill 2221 as amended be forwarded to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Ackerman has moved House Bill 2221A as amended to the floor with a due pass. Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Ferrar?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Work?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 2221A has amended moves the floor with a due pass. And Representative Ackerman, I believe you're the carrier again.
I will. Thank you.
Open the work session on House Bill 2359.
The committee House Bill 2359 has dash one amendments that were adopted in the civil subcommittee. This is a bill that comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission. It is making further changes to the bill that was passed by the Legislative Assembly last session that was also brought by the Oregon Law Commission regarding judgments. That was a rather large and comprehensive bill, and this bill is making further cleanups from that previous bill.
A motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2359 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved House Bill 2359 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions, objections? Call the roll, please.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Ward?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 2359 is amended, goes to the floor with a due pass. And the rest of the floor, did you carry? Open work session on House Bill 2373.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, House Bill 2373 was passed out of the Civil Subcommittee on April 25th. This bill prohibits civil actions against manufacturers and sellers of firearms and ammunition for damages caused by the unlawful use of the firearm products. It specifies exceptions when the seller knew or should have known that the purchaser was likely to use the firearm to cause physical injury, for products liability, for breach of contract, and for violations of sale, marketing, and licensing statutes.
Have a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Garrard.
I would move House Bill 2373 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrard has moved House Bill 2373 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Ackerman.
Me?
Yep.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to oppose this bill because when it came before the Civil Subcommittee, we had opinions in the court in the file that this bill was unconstitutional. And with that in mind, I met with the proponents and their legal counsel on one occasion and tried to walk through some of these problems, and nothing was particularly resolved. I also understand that they took the matter back to legislative counsel. They have not improved the bill. They have not amended the bill. In my view, it still remains unconstitutional, and for that reason, I will vote no.
Okay, thank you. Any further?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was discussing this the other night with my roommate, who happens to be a senator, and he was saying that this he's a physician, and he was saying if he gets drunk and operates on somebody, then should the manufacturer of that scalpel be liable for that? And he used that analogy to this, and I'll be supporting the bill.
Any further discussion? I believe, I should have checked and read it down, but I believe I read something the other day that they've actually got a bill similar to this at the federal level passed through the House and will be going to the Senate. And if that takes place, this question will finally be set to rest at the federal level, we hope. Any further discussion? Okay, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Ackerman?
No.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
No.
Vice Chair McPherson?
No.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 2373 passes the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Garrard, would you like to carry?
I will. Thank you, sir.
Open work session, House Bill 2524.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, House Bill 2524 was passed out of the Civil Subcommittee on April 18th. This is a bill that was brought to us by the General Landlord Tenant Coalition, consists of 13 landlord and tenant advocates. They come together and compromise on changes that need to be made to the landlord tenant law. They've changed six or seven specific areas, which are outlined in the summary. This bill does have dash 3 amendments that need to be adopted. The reason the dash 2 amendments were not adopted in the Civil Subcommittee was because an issue came up regarding the use of the term final judgment when it should be the term general judgment. It has nothing to do with the substance of these bills or of these changes. It's just making a change that's necessary. So that's the only change from the dash 2 to the dash 3 amendments.
Motion on the bill?
Representative Garrard.
Mr. Chair, I would move the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2524A.
Discussion on the adoption of amendments. Any opposition? They're in the bill. Need a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I would move 2524A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrard has moved House Bill 2524A with the dash 3 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any other comments, objections? Call the roll, please.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Ferrari?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye.
House Bill 2524 has amended, moves to the floor with a due pass. Representative Garrard, would you carry again, please?
I will, Mr. Chair.
Open the work session on House Bill 2662.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, House Bill 2662 was passed out of the Civil Subcommittee on April 27th, where it adopted the dash 4 amendments. This bill prohibits the Employment Department from disqualifying individuals who are victims or parents or guardians of minor children who are victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking from receiving unemployment benefits if those individuals leave work or avoid other available work in order to protect themselves or their minor children from further domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking. Currently, there is a statute like this on the books. House Bill 2662 expands it in a couple of ways. First, by including parents or guardians of minor children, and it also includes sexual assault and stalking to reasons that those individuals can leave work and still receive unemployment benefits. Two other changes that it makes. Right now, under the statute, that individual has to be in danger at work, and this statute clarifies or changes that to say that the individual can be at danger at work or elsewhere and still leave work. The final change is that under the current statutes, that person is required to comply with every reasonable available alternative, and this statute or this bill provides a little bit more leeway, saying that the person only must comply with reasonable available alternatives, not every reasonable available alternative.
We adopted the amendment in the sub.
Yes, we did.
Okay, need a motion on the bill? Representative Garrard.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2662 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Holden's bill?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Representative Garrard has moved House Bill 2662 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
Good note, Representative Holden's hard work on this bill. He's taken this not only to this committee, but to the Speaker's office, to the Employment Department, and did all the checkoffs that were particularly necessary to bring this bill back to the committee. It's a very good bill. I'd like to have him considered for as a carrier or co-carrier.
He twisted my arm to some degree.
I was there.
We got the amendment to where it was acceptable.
Thank you.
Okay, any further discussion?
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye.
House Bill 2662 is amended goes before the due pass recommendation. We will have Representative Holby be the carrier. Representative Garrard, if you want to speak to the bill, I'd appreciate that too. I assume on that one we're going to get quite a few of them speak to the bill. Okay, we'll open a work session on House Bill 2730.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, House Bill 2730 comes to you from the Civil Subcommittee. It was passed out April 25th with the Dash 3 amendments. This bill provides civil immunity for radio and television broadcasters who participate in the AMBER plan. The amendments were consensus amendments that clarify that cable companies would also be included in this immunity, and it also provides that civil immunity does not apply for intentional misconduct or gross negligence.
Where's the... Have a motion on the bill, Representative Garrard.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2730 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrard has moved House Bill 2730 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I just have one question, if I could, of the Council.
McPherson, and then Representative.
My notes on the first hearing on this indicate there's an issue of retroactivity, and I'm just has that issue been resolved?
I see that Section 2 of the Dash 3 amendments say that this bill only applies to
right
acts after
okay,
the
that's fine. That satisfies the point.
There was no referral on this one.
That's yes. Correct.
Representative Worth, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to state for the record that I will be opposing this bill. I certainly understand the rationale by which it was brought to the committee. But during testimony, the proponents actually said they couldn't envision an act or omission on the part of the broadcaster that would apply in this sense. So I think the fact that the right to trial by jury overrides then this attempt to provide kind of immunity for something that even the proponents could not envision happening. So okay. Those reasons I'll be opposing.
Representative Ackerman?
Yes, so once again, Mr. Chairman, this bill does grant a form of civil immunity, and I believe, therefore, it has is constitutionally suspect under Article 1, Sections 7 and 10 of the Oregon Constitution. I think this is, I will be making these arguments, making these points, as immunity is continuously sought for many groups to avoid civil liability for their negligent or intentional conduct. I think it's bad policy. I think it's unconstitutional. I think that the extension of immunity to persons wholesale across the board for their wrongful activities is not a good argument for public accountability or good public policy.
Any further comments? Representative Garrard.
Mr. Chair, I'll just point out what we're talking about in this bill is broadcasting AMBER alert information and remind the committee that the broadcaster in this case is attempting to do something good and relies upon the information that is supplied to it by law enforcement. And that's what this bill is simply to prevent if law enforcement happens to give broadcasters erroneous information and the broadcasters broadcast it in good faith. That's all this bill does. So I don't think that we're excusing the broadcasters from a wrongdoing. I think that's an over-exaggeration.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with the good representative that it's the Amber Alert. We're trying to help the kids, trying to rescue the kids. I don't think this would prevent a lawsuit should the law enforcement give the wrong information. The person could go back after the law enforcement where the original information came from. But this protects the broadcasters from a lawsuit that they may not need to be part of when they're trying to help with the Amber program.
Thank you.
Anything further?
Mr. Chair, just kind of support what Representative Barker said, too, on that, as well as Representative Girard. The transportation, the local media, and the broadcasters, this is all voluntary on their part to jump in and to be part of Amber Alert. I was involved several years back with the establishment here in this state with it to some degree, having my connection with communication at that time. The point being, though, is that there is protocols in place that law enforcement has to follow, and it's accurate for that information to be forwarded then to the broadcasting and the local media, and they use that. So I'm supportive of this.
Any further?
Mr. Chair. I think that this bill is well-intentioned, and certainly nobody intends to hold broadcasters who are providing a public service, in effect, by broadcasting an Amber Plan alert liable, and in fact, there was no evidence brought forward that there would any such liability ever been asserted against a broadcaster. I think that the problem is in a blanket kind of civil immunity for something that could be covered by, say, a Tort Claims Act limitation if it were brought against a public agency, because in effect what's happening is the broadcaster is acting as an agent of public jurisdiction and really shouldn't be held liable beyond the exposure that public jurisdiction would have under the rules of the Tort Claims Act. So while I think that certainly there's no desire to hold broadcasters liable, I'll be a no on this bill because I think the idea of a blanket immunity isn't the right way to solve that problem.
Okay. Anything further? We had a motion on the bill, did we?
I think I already made the motion, Mr. Chair.
Call the roll then, please.
Representative Ackerman?
No.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Ward?
No.
Vice Chair McPherson?
No.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 2730 moves to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Girard, I believe you're the carrier again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Open a work session on House Bill 2831.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, House Bill 2831 was passed out of the Civil Subcommittee on April 25th. They adopted the Dash 1 amendments. This bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means Committee. This bill allows municipal courts to assign judgments and criminal actions to the Department of Revenue. Currently, justice courts and circuit courts can do this, and this brings municipal courts up to that level as well.
So, a motion on the bill? Representative Ackerman?
Yes, I'll move that House Bill 2831A be forwarded to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Ackerman has moved House Bill 2831A. Does that go to the floor?
Goes to Ways and Means.
There'll be no carrier to the Ways and Means. We do pass. Any further discussion? Overall, please.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Ferrar?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Ward?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 2831A moves to Ways and Means. Open a work session on House Bill 3158.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, House Bill 3158 requires that certain causes of action related to improvement of real property be commenced within 6 years after substantial completion or abandonment of construction, alteration, or repair. Currently, the ultimate statute of repose, or the statute of ultimate repose, is 10 years. This lowers that, which means that individuals who find some sort of defect in that property after that six-year period would be barred from bringing that action. The Dash 1 amendments, which were adopted in the Civil Subcommittee, exempt single-family residential dwellings, which means that those dwellings would still be subject to the longer 10-year statute of ultimate repose.
Any motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, first a little preface kind of explaining what the situation is on this bill. The statute of repose is currently at 10 years, and this would shorten it to 6, as was described by counsel. There was an amendment that was adopted in the civil sub to exclude single-family residential structures from the scope of the bill. There's been some further discussion about that amendment, and there is a consensus forming that the bill should move forward without that exception. So I'm about to make a motion that will move the bill forward unamended, that is, disregarding the dash one amendments that were adopted by the civil sub. Also, to further explain my own position, although I will make that motion, I will be opposing the bill because in looking at the status of the statute of repose among the 51 states plus the 50 states plus the District of Columbia, I find that by far the predominant pattern is to have a statute of repose that is at least 10 years, and in some states longer, and in fact in the case of 4 states, no statute of repose. So this would take Oregon to outside of the mainstream of states, although there are some other states, including a couple of bordering states, that have a 6-year statute. And it would, based on input that I've received, be upsetting a balance of risk that exists among the various participants in construction projects, that is the contractor, the property owner, the developer, people providing financing. And so on that basis, I'll be voting no on the bill. But for purposes of moving it forward, I do make the motion that the bill be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation without the dash one amendments.
Representative McPherson has moved House Bill 3158 without the dash one amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Garrard.
Mr. Chair, there was testimony in committee that about 80% of these construction problems were actually just leaks, and there was testimony that 6 years should be long enough to find a leak.
Okay. Further comments, Representative Worth?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I supported this in the subcommittee with still some unresolved issues, but if the amendment is taken out, then I will have to oppose the bill. Even with the amendment, I was concerned that only single-family residential dwellings were added and not multifamily or duplexes. So without the amendment, I will have to oppose the bill.
Representative Flores?
Mr. Chair, I do have some conflict with this bill, just as a matter of being troubled and considered just leaks. We do have evidence that those create some very significant problems in the long term. However, I will be continuing to support this bill. I just have some conflict with the compression, but I will support the bill.
Thank you. Further? Call the roll.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
No.
Vice Chair McPherson?
No.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 3158 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrard, do you want to
carry another one?
Yes.
You're going to be busy next week.
All right.
Open a work session on House Bill 3352.
Chair Krieger moves the committee. House Bill 3352 provides that a decedent surviving parent or the heirs of or the devisees of the parents may not inherit by intestacy if the decedent lacked capacity to make a will for at least 5 years before the death and the parent failed to provide support for the decedent for a period of 10 years. Before the decedent reached the age of 18 years of age. This bill is closing a loophole in the intestacy succession statutes. Right now, if an individual dies without a will, statutes provide how that individual's estate is passed. If the individual does not have a spouse or children, that that individual's property passes to his or her parents. This bill provides an exception for parents who were not involved in that individual's life, have not supported that child. I need to mention that this committee needs, there are amendments that need to be adopted by the committee, -4 amendments. The -3 amendments had some minor technical errors that were fixed. That was in Section 3, Subsection B. And that provides a deterrence. Where the parent provides no support for the decedent during the lifetime. It was just a minor language fix. So again, this committee would need to adopt the -4 amendments.
So I want to make a motion to adopt the amendments.
Mr. Chair, I would move the adoption of the -4 amendments to House Bill 3352.
Representative Flores has moved to adopt the -4 amendments into House Bill 3352. Any objections? Not so ordered. Need a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3352 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved House Bill 3352 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any comments? Objections? Call the roll, please.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Patrick?
Aye.
Representative Work?
Aye.
Vice Chairman Person?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye.
House Bill 3352 amended and has moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
How did you get over?
I have no idea. I think Chair Ackerman has some kind of resentment for me.
Change resentment to a paid dinner out.
Uh-huh. Well, I have Representative Ackerman also shares my land use committee with me, and I think this is what is commonly called payback time.
Okay. Thank you.
But as we get to Measure 37.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay, we'll open a work session on H.J.R. 31.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, H.J.R. 31 proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution to allow the House of Representatives to impeach certain elected officials. It specifies the grounds for impeachment and requires trial by the Senate. The -2 amendments were adopted by the Civil Subcommittee. Those amendments established the impeachment procedures.
Motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I would move H.J.R. 31 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved H.J.R. 31 to the floor with a due pass. Any comments? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I want to first say that the persons and parties that brought this matter to our attention are certainly well-intended and have demonstrated by their participation in the committee process a high degree of political involvement, and I think they should be commended for bringing the resolution to our attention. On the merits of the proposal, I feel that it is defective in very, very many avenues. The idea that you can impeach for negligence, which is the lowest standard of conduct, I think is not desirable. There's no tie-in of the negligent act to the official duties of the officers involved. The impeachment process, as I understand it, takes you down to the agency level, so you can impeach officers or employees of the state that are not publicly elected. It applies, of course, to all other public statewide elected employees, including the governor, secretary of state, and the judges who are served by public election. It's really kind of funny, I think, for us to adopt this and say we can impeach all these other people, and yet we don't put ourselves on the same line. We don't impeach ourselves on this. The representatives of this assembly and the senators of this assembly are not subject to impeachment of this act, and yet we're do a very low threshold for the impeachment of others in similar situations. I find that's inconsistent and extremely poor policy. There are other defects in the bill, particularly in the reporting process and how complaints get filed. I think there's a great, great degree for political mischief here, as public elected officials that are subject to impeachment are engaging in campaigns, and you're going to have opposition people filing requests for impeachment based upon some form of negligence, which could be, like as I said, not attributed to the official's official conduct. I can see this have a great partisan effect, which I think is we're trying to avoid in many aspects of our the initiation of governmental policy. So for those reasons, I feel that the resolution is entirely misplaced, and I think there was ample evidence suggested before the committee to indicate that there are other lawful methods for the removal of public officials from office. Thank you.
It's been covered very effectively by Representative Ashton, and I'm in concurrence with his comments.
Any further comments?
I just to have a brief one. I was thinking about this bill the other night, and I was thinking forward to the day when there's 35 Democrats on the House floor, and my good friend Kevin Manning sitting in the governor's office, and the mischief this would open. And I'm going to vote no.
Any further? Give me just a minute here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
Due to the fact that this does not include members of either the House or the Senate of this legislative body, I would like to withdraw my motion.
Okay, thank you. Any further comment? We are not going to move the bill. I will close the work session on the bill. H.J.R. 31. Open a work session on HM 3.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, House Memorial 3 requests that Congress enact legislation to protect firearms and ammunition manufacturers, distributors, dealers, and importers from abusive and ill-conceived tort actions.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Memorial 3 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved House Memorial 3 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objections, discussion? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, just to register my opposition again for the reasons I previously stated on the previous gun bill. And I think to the extent to which this House Memorial wants to link us to federal legislation is vast intrusion upon states' rights, and I believe we should be able to settle this ourselves and not be locked into federal legislation.
Any other comments? not, call the roll, please.
Representative Ackerman?
No.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Farrar?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Ward?
No.
Vice Chair McPherson?
No.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. HM3 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Flores, you are the carrier.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Regarding HM4, we're going to pull that back. There's a couple word changes I'd like to make. I talked to Representative Summer, sponsor, and so we will be handling that at a different date. House Bill 2156. We'll open a work session on that.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2156 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Sorry, I just skipped ahead of you. I was just excited. I like it.
If I could, Representative Thatcher. The only thing I wanted to point out is that my SMS that was sent out to you does say due pass is amended. This came from the criminal subcommittee as a due pass. There are no amendments in this, and I will make that correction. I did also receive a report from the fiscal office that there is no fiscal impact on this bill either. It would ratify the National Crime Prevention and Privacy Compact and enable Oregon to become a party state. No amendment.
Now,
would you like me to do this again?
Sure.
Goody, twice. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2156 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thatcher has moved House Bill 2156 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any other discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Farrar?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Ward?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 2156 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Thatcher, would you be the carrier?
Yes.
Open a work session on House Bill 2224.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2224 would require an appellate court, after reversing some but not all counts on appeal, to remand the case to the trial court for resentencing on the remaining counts. This bill comes to us from the Attorney General's office. It clarifies an area of law that's handled differently at the appellate level, depending on the panel of judges. Sometimes it gets sent back for resentencing, other times it does not. And the Attorney General pointed out there was a fairly recent case, State versus Fry, where the trial court originally sentenced the defendant to a total of 300 months prison. And the defendant was convicted of several counts, and so some of those counts were sentenced consecutively, meaning they were stacked one on top of the other, some concurrently, meaning that they would be served at the same time. And when the Court of Appeals reversed the convictions on three of the counts, some of those were the consecutive counts, and what ended up happening was, because this case was not remanded, the defendant ended up getting a 200-month reduction in his prison sentence from 300 to 100 months. And, you know, if the Court of Appeals had sent all of those counts back, the trial court may or may not have made the adjustment, but the trial court, being familiar with the facts of the case, the proponents of this bill would assert the trial court is the appropriate body to sentence. There were dash one amendments. They were adopted, I believe, yes, they were adopted on April 21st by the Criminal Subcommittee.
Motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2224 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson has moved House Bill 2224 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Was there an amendment you said on that?
Yes.
As amended. Any discussion? Call the roll.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Farrar?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Ward?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 2224 as amended has been moved to the floor, passed to move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Thatcher, do you want to carry, please?
Yes, sir.
Open work session on House Bill 2233.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, House Bill 2233 comes to you from the Criminal Subcommittee with a DUPASS as amended recommendation. It was a unanimous vote, and that is the dash two amendments that we are discussing here. This would provide that judgment in a criminal action containing an award of restitution would not expire until 50 years after the entry of judgment. That changes the current law, which is set at 20 years. Proponents asserted that the reason this was important is a lot of times if you have a young offender, someone who commits their offense at 18, 19, 20, it may take them a longer period of time to sort of get it together, start working, and be able to make those restitution payments. So the 50-year, the extension to 50 years was suggested. We did discuss at subcommittee the interest rate, which was 9% for the entire 50 years. Representative McPherson worked with the Attorney General's office and settled on a interest rate of 12.5% per annum from the date of entry of judgment for the first 5 years, and then reducing that interest rate to 4% per annum for every year thereafter.
Motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2233 as amended to the floor with a DUPASS recommendation.
Representative McPherson has moved House Bill 2233 as amended to the floor with a DUPASS recommendation. Any discussion?
Let me just explain what might strike some as a little bit of an unusual structure on the interest, just so people are comfortable with that. Originally, it was going to be 9% straight for all 50 years, and the concern about that is because it's an above market rate of interest, it would actually overstate the amount a person owes over the long pull, and the interest component becomes a very significant component. The reason why it's a higher rate in the first 5 years is to give an incentive for early payment, because those who have means should, and we think will, respond to that high interest rate as an incentive. But for those who don't get it paid off within that first 5 years, then the 4% would not then keep compounding at a high rate that would overstate over the long pull the obligation.
Okay, thank you. Anything further on that? Call roll, please.
Representative Backerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 2233 moves to the floor with a DUPASS recommendation. And Representative McPherson, do you want to carry the bill?
Thank you.
Open work session on House Bill 2322.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2322 comes to you from your Criminal Subcommittee with a unanimous DUPASS as amended recommendation. This bill was originally here at the request of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. What House Bill 2322 would do as amended is expand assault in the first degree, which is a ballot measure 11 offense, to include intentionally or knowingly causing serious physical injury to a child under 13 years of age. The amendments add an additional condition that the defendant must be 5 years older than the victim, and that was intended to sort of exclude those schoolyard fight type situations. For the committee's information, assault in the second degree, which is what this type of assault would be prosecuted under now, is also a ballot measure 11 offense. It is a ballot measure 11 offense punishable by 70 months mandatory minimum. Assault in the first degree is 90 months mandatory minimum. So this bill, in my discussions with the Criminal Justice Commission, is going to have no fiscal impact because any impact will not be felt in the next two biennia.
Question?
Yes. For those of you looking at the agenda that says under 14 years of age, that was the initial bill. The amended bill does reduce the age to 13.
Need a motion on the bill? Representative Olson?
Mr. Chair, I would move that House Bill 2322 as amended be moved to the House floor for with the DUPASS recommendation.
Representative Olson has moved House Bill 2322 as amended to the floor with the DUPASS recommendation. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I have kind of a strange question, but I know right now the law does not currently recognize a full-term pregnancy as a child, but
How, if at some point we did, how young of a child are we talking about? Could this potentially extend to a domestic violence situation where a full-term pregnant woman was battered and the child was born with injuries due to that?
That wasn't discussed, was it?
Representative Wirth, it wasn't discussed, but my sense of the state of the law would be that a newborn child born deformed or somehow affected by an in utero assault would not be covered by this expansion of the law. I think that you would have to change the definition of child, and in that this bill at least does not do that.
Okay. I just want to say that I'm very supportive of the bill, but the shaken baby syndrome is a huge problem, so I'm supporting such bill.
Further?
Representative Backman?
Aye.
Representative
Barker?
Aye.
Representative
Flores?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Flores? Aye. Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Vice Chairman Person? Aye. Vice Chair
Olson? Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye.
House Bill 2322 is amended, goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and Representative Olson, you're the carrier?
Yes.
Thank you. Open a work session, House Bill 2360.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2360 would impose a fine and mandatory jail time for persons convicted of driving while under the influence of intoxicants if that person had a 0.20% or higher blood alcohol content. Currently, as you know, a person is guilty of driving under the influence of intoxicants, particularly in this case alcohol, when they have 0.08% or more BAC. This would take those extremely high BACs, 0.20% or more, which is more than twice the legal limit, and it would punish those people a little more harshly. A first conviction for DUII would impose a minimum of a $2,500 fine as opposed to the minimum $1,000 fine that the law requires if it were under 0.20. Additionally, it would require the court to sentence a person to 7 days in jail as opposed to the 2 days in jail that a court would have to impose now. If the individual was a second or subsequent offender and blew a 0.20 or higher, they would be looking at a 60-day minimum jail sentence. I would note that the statute does leave open the possibility of that jail sentence being served at an inpatient treatment program, sort of a day-for-day credit type of idea, or work release program, so that an individual would potentially not have to lose their job over it. And it would require, I believe, the same minimum fine of $2,500. We did hear in the subcommittee that that statistically speaking, a person at 0.15% or higher is 300 times more likely to be involved in a fatal accident, and that 31 other states have enhanced penalties based on higher blood alcohol content levels. But we did also hear concerns about this bill because with the sort of revolving door jail situation that a lot of our local jails are experiencing right now, there was concern that precious jail beds would go to a DUI offender, and we did also hear concerns about taking away the discretion from the sentencing court.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House Bill 2360 to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Barker has moved House Bill 2360 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I want to quiz counsel further on something that I didn't recall hearing during the work of the subcommittee on this bill. You mentioned just now that it is within the discretion of the court under this bill for the sentence to be served not as an in-jail sentence, but to be served in a treatment program. I didn't recall hearing that, and so that's a pretty significant point to me. So I voted against this bill in the sub, but if that may affect this dynamic I was concerned about whether we're saying we're going to be requiring by statute that there be 7 days on the first offense and 60 days on the second offense time served in jail, that jail bed being something that then we're not looking at providing to for a repeat property, a criminal, for example.
Representative McPherson, if you look on page 3 of the bill at lines 4 and 5, 3 through 5, for the purposes of this subsection, which the subsection is this enhancement of 7 or 60 days, a court may provide for the imprisonment to be served in jail, minimum security facilities, which would include something like work release, or inpatient rehabilitation or treatment centers. So that's that is why I believed that to be the case.
Okay. Then that actually answers the concern that I had. I mean, the greatest concern I had was that this was, there was authority for the judge to sentence, the court to sentence an offender to the level of incarceration that's provided here. So this is really a mandatory minimum is what it is, and it's an attempt to preempt what is a very expensive resource we have, which is limited number of jail beds. But it appears to me, under that language, that it's possible then for that time to be not to be jail bed space that's being taken up. So I appreciate that input, and I will be supporting the bill.
Any further discussion? Call the roll.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 2360 moves to the... It didn't have a dash amendment, did it?
It did not.
Okay. It was to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Thatcher, do you want to call carry that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. It appears that maybe Representative Barker does.
Why don't you co-carry it? Okay. It might take two of you to get it done.
Okay.
House Bill 2361, open work session.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2361 came to us essentially as a housekeeping bill. Last session, those of you who were members of the legislature passed a law that would require a court to revoke an individual's driving privileges in the state of Oregon upon their third DUII offense. The law specifically said upon their third DUII offense, and it became an issue when it was a person's fourth, fifth, sixth, or greater offense. And while I did not personally have knowledge of a case, I heard at least through the grapevine that at least one judge upon a non-third but greater offense said, hey, the statute's clear, it says third offense, and therefore I am not going to revoke this person's driving privileges. So this clarifies that it is a third or subsequent offense for a lifetime revocation. There were dash one amendments. They were suggested to us to clarify after a 10-year period of time, an individual whose driving privileges were revoked can apply to the court for reconsideration of that revocation. And this clarifies the difference between someone who's given a probationary sentence and a prison sentence when that 10-year period of time would begin to toll.
Any motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2361 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker has moved House Bill 2361 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions, conversations? Call the roll, please.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 2361, as amended, moves to the floor with a due pass, and I believe Representative Barker is the carrier.
Thank you.
Thank you. Open work session on House Bill 2568.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2568 would require the circuit court in Gresham to transfer proceedings to a court facility in Portland if the accused is in the custody of the county sheriff or Department of Corrections, or if the circuit court issues an arrest warrant for the accused in a pending criminal action. It would also require the accused to request transfer from the court in Gresham to the court in Portland at the first appearance. I actually served in the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office as the Gresham District Court Deputy for a period of time, and I can tell you a couple of things about the courthouse there. It is a building that at one time, when I was there at least, shared space with a dance studio. Tap lessons would go on next to my office. It also shares space with the Veterans Administration there. However, the courthouse handles about 40,000 cases a year, and there is a new facility being planned, but it will not have holding cells either. This one does not have holding cells, and that is why, although the statute is silent, the court in Multnomah County felt it was important to clarify that persons in custody would not have the same right to a trial out at that Gresham Satellite Courthouse. Additionally, what was happening, or at least when I was there and probably continues today, is you have one judge and one DA out there, and typically there is a defense consortium that works out there, and there will be a certain number of setovers each side can have, and what would often happen is you'd get to that second or third setover, and the defense would then request for that case to be sent downtown, and these cases are sometimes taking longer than they ought to get through the criminal justice system. It is only misdemeanor and traffic violations. Felonies are not handled out at the Gresham Courthouse. So this just clarifies a few sort of policy issues that that ought to be in place.
Okay. A motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2568 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson has moved House Bill 2568 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussions? Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, just a quick question of counsel, if I might. I'm absolutely supportive of what you're trying to accomplish here so we can avoid the tap dancing. Are there any other cities in the state that have satellite courthouses that this might, the same situation might occur?
Representative Flores, I believe Lane County, I was looking for Ms. Sugar, but I don't see her in here. I believe Lane County has some satellite courthouses, do they not, for misdemeanors?
Florence.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Representative Ackerman. This is a Gresham courthouse statute that's being amended as opposed to other satellite courthouses. As to the problems that may occur as far as an inter-courthouse transfer, I don't know the answer to that question, but I do know that at least what this statute is doing is amending the statute that specifically provides authority for the Gresham Satellite Court. So if these other counties have their satellite courts and they don't have these problems, this would not affect the way they are doing business.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Beckman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Farrar?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Ward?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 2568 moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative McPherson, you're the carrier?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Open work session on House Bill 2569.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2569 comes to you from your criminal subcommittee with a due pass as amended recommendation. That recommendation is unanimous. This would exempt law enforcement officials acting in the course of official duty from the motor vehicle accident reporting requirements. This basically is before the legislature this session because, as I'm sure you know, by law, If you're involved in an accident with which results in property damage over, I believe it's $1,000, you need to file a report with the Oregon Department of Motor Vehicles. There was no exception for officers who get in accidents as a result of, say, the pursuit intervention technique when an officer intentionally rams into a fleeing car in order to stop the pursuit. The Attorney General's office was asked by the Department of Motor Vehicles, do we need to be requiring police officers to do this? The penalty for failing to report an accident of this nature is a license suspension, and the Attorney General did feel that under a reading of the statute, that police officers who did not report these accidents using the DMV reporting form would be subject to a license suspension. So this creates the exception that will no longer require officers who, in the course of their official duty, engage in an intentional accident, for lack of a better phrase, to not have to report that to DMV and therefore not risk having their license suspended.
Motion on the bill.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd move, as amended, House Bill 2569 to the full floor with due pass recommendation.
These were dash ones, yeah.
Representative Olson has moved House Bill 2569 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 2569, as amended, moves the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Olson, you're the carrier?
Yes. Thank you, sir.
Open a work session on House Bill 2966.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2966 would broaden the class of persons eligible to receive benefits from the Public Safety Memorial Fund. The Dash 1 amendments changed the persons eligible from domestic partners to designees. What this fund essentially does, among other things, is it benefits survivors by paying for things such as funeral expenses, and by survivors, I apologize, I mean police officers and public safety officers who die or who are permanently disabled in the line of duty. Those are the designees that receive benefits under this fund. Designees now could include something like a surviving grandparent, a roommate, a step-relative. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, so we do not need to assign a carrier. We just need to send it on its way.
Do we have a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2966 to the floor with a due pass.
As amended.
As amended.
And there's a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
With a subsequent referral.
Okay. Representative Barker has moved House Bill 2966 as amended with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Further discussion? Okay. Call the roll, please.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye. I'm sorry, aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 2966 moves with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Open a work session on House Bill 2968.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2968 also has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. What this bill would do would be to modify the crimes of theft in all degrees except for aggravated theft by increasing the value of property that must be taken. We heard testimony in the subcommittee that the last time these amounts were adjusted was 1987, and the amounts that this bill proposes were determined by using the Consumer Price Index. As you can see, I just, to make it simpler, did a little table on your staff measure summary that shows you the crime, what crime classification it is, current law, and what House Bill 2968 would do. So, for example, theft in the second degree, a Class A misdemeanor, currently is anything stolen between $50 and $749.99, or anything under $200 if it's theft by receiving, meaning that you knowingly possess stolen property or engage in a transaction regarding stolen property. That would be increased now to $75 and $999.99, or under $400 if it's theft by receiving.
Okay. Need a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, make motion as amended. House Bill 2968 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
That has a referral of Ways and Means.
Correct.
It has a referral of Ways and Means. Representative Olson has moved House Bill 2968 as amended to the floor with referral to Ways and Means. Any further discussion? Call the roll.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Farrar?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Ward?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 2968 does move with the referral to the Ways and Means. Open work session, House Bill 2976.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2976 is before you unanimously from your criminal subcommittee. There are new amendments that do need to be adopted here today. They are dash one amendments. They should be in your packet. It's fairly simple. What this bill does is it modifies the crime of criminal non-support. Currently, if an individual is not paying their child support, then the state has to prove that the person did not pay the support and did not have a lawful excuse for paying the support. This law would change that to make the lawful excuse an affirmative defense, shifting the burden then to the defendant to prove that he or she had a lawful excuse. Lawful excuse is not defined by statute, but is defined in case law as a condition not of the defendant's own making, which prevents the defendant from being able to provide support. And one of the examples that we heard is if a defendant is incarcerated at the time that he or she is supposed to be paying child support, that would be a lawful excuse because they were not earning income. The amendment, the dash one amendment, would change the requirement that the affirmative defense be proved by clear and convincing evidence. All other affirmative defenses in Oregon law are proved by a preponderance of the evidence, which is a slightly lower standard than the clear and convincing evidence standard, and the proponents of the bill agreed to keep that consistent and remove the additional requirement that it be by clear and convincing evidence. Therefore, a defendant would prove by preponderance of the evidence that he or she had a lawful excuse.
Took a long time to say that.
It's a confusing thing.
Have a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment into House Bill 2976.
Representative McPherson has moved that we adopt the dash one amendments into House Bill 2966. Any objections?
2976. A question?
2976.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Girard.
I'm just curious. When does non-support become criminal non-support?
Representative Girard, criminal non-support, I believe, let me look at the entire statute. Under current law, a person commits the crime of criminal non-support if being the parent, lawful guardian, or other person lawfully charged with the support of a child under 18 years of age, the person refuses or neglects to provide support for such child. We heard testimony that to charge someone criminally, the practice across the state is to use this as essentially the last resort. There are many intermediary things that the district attorneys and the attorney general's office do, including contempt proceedings. If the individuals fail to, what will happen is if there's a divorce settlement and the individual fails to live up to their obligations, the first step is a contempt proceeding. The second step is a support enforcement division of a district attorney or the attorney general's office getting involved. And then I think this is sort of the third step and used really for only the most egregious examples. I suspect that Representative Ackerman, who does a little bit more civil law practice, might be able to give us a little more information on the steps.
I would need about 15 minutes.
Oh. Okay.
We'll do it later.
Okay.
Unless the representative is not satisfied with the answer, which I think is well done.
My primary concern here is that I don't see any period of time. In other words, somebody who misses the first payment on a child support could, in essence, be charged with criminal non-support. As I've listened to you, I'm not an attorney. I'm just sitting here saying, wow, you could go arrest somebody for missing one payment, being 5 days late. There's no determination here as to when a criminal crime is committed. And I don't know, that kind of really concerns me a little bit.
Representative Gerard, I would say that is accurate. I would note, it doesn't probably change your analysis, but I would note that at least that portion of the law is not something that we're amending or changing here today. I mean, that has been the law since this statute was enacted, and I frankly would have to do a little research to know how long this law has been on the books. But you're right. As a technical matter, I do believe that you are correct, but my understanding is that that would be something that would not ever happen. From all of my personal experience and from the information that I have that we heard in committee. Now, is it possible that someone could be charged? The answer is yes. But has it happened? My information is no.
Let me comment a little bit about this. This is outside of my area of practice entirely, but what I see is happening here is that we already have a statute that creates a crime of failure to pay child support. And that was a policy choice made by a prior legislature, and perhaps that ought to be reconsidered. The way it works now is that it has an exception for lawful excuse, and the burden of proving that and the burden of proving it beyond a reasonable doubt then rests with the state to prove that element. And what this change would do is without raising again sort of the broader policy choice of whether we should use the criminal law system as a backstop or an extra enforcement tool to get people to pay their child support, we're shifting in the burden of proving that there was no lawful excuse from the state to the defendant to establish that, but that by this amendment it would only by a preponderance of the evidence. So it is I think we've raised the policy issue because we're shifting in a sort of technical way where the burden is, but the broader policy decision is one made several sessions ago. Now we could decide we don't want the criminal law system used for this purpose, and that would be a legitimate debate to have, but it's not the what this bill is before us to do.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate Representative McPherson's explanation, and I understand the difference of where we're going, so I will support the bill. So.
It's good to have some attorneys sometimes.
Mr. Chair, they're all around us.
Mr. Chair, I do have a question.
Okay.
If you were moving.
I was going to, but okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and of counsel. Your definition of non-support refuses or neglects to provide support. Does this bill in any way address where the parent who is supposed to be providing support claims that they are either self-employed or unemployed, yet as evidenced by their lifestyle, there is a significant imputed income, and they are not supporting.
Representative Flores, that's an interesting question, and Representative Thatcher asked a similar one at the subcommittee level. It does not have, I think that that would be the lawful excuse issue, and that is, I think, why at least this bill is attempting to shift that burden, because it is difficult for the state to prove a negative in order to say, no, he had no lawful excuse, whereas the defendant could come forth and, the state would be able to rebut an affirmative defense, for example, if there was evidence that he had a yacht off of the coast of the Cayman Islands, or she had a yacht off the coast of the Cayman Islands and was, living the life fantastic, but, oh, look, I haven't collected an income in 12 years, so you can't say that I can pay my child support. I do believe that's all evidence that would come in at trial, although this bill does not specifically address those types of situations. I just think it would be an evidentiary question for a jury or a court.
Mr. Chair, I will be supporting this bill, yet I think that particular path is something that we need to continue down, and I'm hopeful that there are some that I've expressed that concern to already, and we will work toward trying to rein in some of those excuses.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a question also for counsel, because as I read the bill, we're doing more than simply shifting the burden to prove whether or not the defendant did or did not have a lawful excuse. In effect, I think how they read it is that with the amendments, especially, we're making it easier to prove a defendant had a lawful excuse. So right now, the state, therefore, in the staff measure summary, would have the burden under the current statute to prove that a defendant did not have a lawful excuse beyond reasonable doubt. So tell me how that differs than if we basically did the reverse or the flip of what we're asking in this bill, and we made it so that the state would have the burden under the current statute to prove by preponderance of the evidence that a defendant did not have a lawful excuse. Representative Worth, what the law would require the state to do now is to prove that the defendant did not have a lawful excuse beyond a reasonable doubt. And what we heard in testimony in the subcommittee is that the idea of proving there was no lawful excuse is a lot more difficult for the state, who has to jump through several hoops to do such things as subpoena, bank records, subpoena medical records if the excuse is going to be, for example, I can't work because I'm disabled, to do all of those things. This shifts to the defendant that they have to prove it by a preponderance of the evidence that they had a lawful excuse. So the defendant can simply provide that information to a judge or jury. I think I got a little confused by your question. The state then the burden shifts to the defendant entirely, and then but it's a lower burden. So the defendant then will prove it by a preponderance, where the state would prove the negative beyond a reasonable doubt. I don't know if I answered your question or not.
Follow up?
So
it's making it easier then to provide a lawful excuse and affirmative action or affirmative defense, basically easier to get in the sense of not providing support. So how would this bill then be different than, let's say, if we made it that the defendant would have to prove then beyond a reasonable doubt that some condition not of his or her own making prevents the defendant from providing support.
Representative Worth, I want to make sure that what you're saying is we ought not make it easy for a deadbeat parent to just assert this defense. Is that basically what you're saying? Okay. I think the reason for that is, well, I think it's constitutional to a certain extent that a defendant ought not have to prove his innocence beyond a reasonable doubt, that it is the state's burden to prove their guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. I think that in addition to that, that by shifting any of the burden to the defendant at all, you're throwing something on them that normally isn't there. So I do think actually that this is more, it's more difficult for a defendant. It's more onerous, I guess is the word I'm searching for a defendant that he has to prove anything as opposed to in a normal trial where a defendant would have to put on no evidence and the state has to prove every single element. So what this bill is doing is shifting some of the burden to the defendant, but constitutionally, I don't believe that that it would withstand constitutional muster to require the defendant to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. And as I mentioned, already they had elevated it to clear and convincing evidence, and that met with a great deal of resistance because it was inconsistent with all of the other affirmative defenses.
All right. Final question? Can I have a final question, Mr. Chair?
Dana, please.
I think I appreciate your explanation here. My question is then would it be easier for a defendant then to prove, because I think the definition of lawful excuse is pretty broad. It's just that some condition not of the defendant's own making prevents the defendant from being able to provide support. So. And if I was being charged with that, let's say, as this law stands now, and the state would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this was true, that I was guilty of this. Now, under this, if we change the law, wouldn't it be easier then for me then to prove, though, that I had this lawful excuse that, in fact, there was some condition not of my own making prevented me from being able to provide support? Wouldn't it be easier for me to prove that that was true, therefore getting a lawful excuse simply because I only have to provide a preponderance of the evidence and not be proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of doing so?
Representative Worth, I don't think so, because the problem is this, the way that I understand this law, and this is a statute that I personally have never prosecuted under, but the problem is that a state prosecutor would have to guess what a defendant's lawful excuse might be and disprove that. So, for example, what would happen is the jury would be instructed at the end of the trial. Let's say that we go through a trial and the state has proven that you were the parent and you had been ordered to pay child support and that you hadn't done it for 6 months, and I could prove that 7 months ago she made a payment and then she stopped making payments for the next 6 months and she didn't have a lawful excuse. But then the defense attorney could get up in closing argument, for example, and say, well, how do you know she didn't have a lawful excuse? She could have been disabled. She could have been incarcerated. She could have been, deployed to Iraq. I'm just trying to think of some examples. And I would not, as a prosecutor, have known to check the military records to see if you were deployed to Iraq, and that could be reasonable doubt for a jury, that I did not disprove a lawful excuse. Now, I can say, she was ordered to pay child support, she didn't pay it for 6 months, and that's all I have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, and then you would say to a jury, no, look, I was deployed to Iraq for those 6 months, and the jury would potentially acquit you, but you would have to prove that lawful excuse, as opposed to me trying to sort of shotgun guess what your lawful excuse might or might not be. So I think it's a weird concept, but it's the idea of the state having to prove or disprove a negative. The state having to guess what your lawful excuse might be and say you didn't have one, whereas you saying, no, actually, I do have one. And quite frankly, I think if a if a criminal defendant came to the state, I mean, as you can see, that subsection 4 requires notice to the district attorney. If a lawful excuse was proven, my suspicion is that there would be that it would not go to trial, that it would resolve itself one way or the other pretrial. If in fact there was a really good legitimate excuse as to why the defendant was not paying child support, if the state doesn't believe the lawful excuse, then they go to trial and the defendant state puts on their evidence, defendant puts on their evidence, and there's an argument and a question for the trier of fact, be that jury or court, to decide whether or not they really think that's a good excuse to not pay child support. Does that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Any further discussion? You're kidding.
Yes, I'm not kidding. I need to ask a question of counsel, and I commend Representatives Worth and Garrard for raising this point, because I didn't see this until I started making it. If you take without lawful excuse out of the element of the offense, what's left is that a person can commit the crime of non-support by the mere refusal to pay child support. My question to counsel is, what's the culpable mental state? Have we eliminated that, and therefore you can't state a crime in the indictment?
Representative Ackerman, I believe that the law assumes a culpable mental state in cases like this, and the law would assume at least unknowingly. I'm looking up at our representatives from the Department of Justice to see if I'm not misleading the... Actually, that would be great if you wouldn't mind coming up as I struggle with that particular question.
Identify yourself, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carl Stecker. I'm Deputy District Attorney here in Marion County, here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Council has done a remarkable job, I think, of explaining the essence of the issues that have been addressed. With regard to the intentionality element, it has been found by the Court of Appeals. I can give you a cite if you give me a moment. With respect to... It's a knowing, intentional standard has been inferred by the court. It's not explicitly in the statute, but it is in the body of the case law that under which the statute's been interpreted. This statute's been on the books since 1898, something like that. It was amended in 1921 and amended again in the 50s, but essentially it's been the same essential law for all these years.
Okay.
Criminal non-support does not require a culpable mental state, but by reason of general statute, culpability is nonetheless required and is established only if the defendant acts intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, or with criminal negligence. And they cite ORS 161-115 sub 2. That was decided in States versus Gartsky, a 1979 case from the Oregon Court of Appeals, found at 39 Oregon Appeals 463. And that interpretation has not been amended.
Any questions?
Or have we that's under the old law. That's not under the law as would be amended by House Bill 2976, where you've taken without lawful excuse out of the element of the offense, and you're just left with a mere refusal to pay. I'm still curious how the court grafts into that a standard of mental culpability to create a crime.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman.
I mean, is it stated in the statute that if there is no culpable intent stated in the definition of the offense, that we then get to plug into something else?
Certainly, the use of the alternative or neglects with refuses or neglects, refusal would clearly indicate a culpable mental state of intentionality. What I might suspect is the word neglect might cause the representative an issue.
I disagree with that, but my prediction is that this is now ripe for litigation, and we do risk losing the criminality of the non-payment of non-support. I just think it's an arguable issue. We're not going to settle it today, but I think there's some risks in going forward. Defense counsel is going to pick up on this real quick.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, because the statute still permits the affirmative defense of lawful excuse, it certainly gives someone that option to provide information to the court or trier of fact with respect to the person's ability or inability to pay. And clearly, if they are able to demonstrate an actual inability to pay by virtue of a medical excuse, incarceration, whatever circumstances there exist that are beyond their control, clearly they would the trier of fact would have the opportunity to decide that in fact this person was not capable or did not refuse to pay their support.
Representative Ackerman.
It's going to be resolved someplace else, Mr. Chairman, I think, if the bill passes.
Would you like some time to look into it? We have not moved the bill.
No, it's just a question of whether I think counsel thinks it's serious enough where we should back off and take another look at this. We don't have the time to exhaust it today, and I would feel better putting it in counsel's pocket. I mean, we all are a little bit limited on time, but I think that's their role rather than mine.
Would you prefer to bring it back to your criminal sub and talk about it? Or do you want to take a move?
I said Barker's assembly. This is where it would go.
Bring it on. It's Barker. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not to insert into that particular discussion whether it should go back to Co-Chair Barker's or criminal subcommittee, but I do have another question. I'm sorry that this is just all of a sudden percolated to the top, but since you brought it up.
Oh, dear.
Okay, what did I do? Would this bill, with an enhanced opportunity, I think, to capture non-support, is what I'm understanding it to do, have any type of look back to any support matter that is currently in the process and where there has been conflicting and perhaps perjurious affidavits indicating on one level no income or modest income, and another document affidavit therefore affirmed and attested to that there is significant income?
I again, Representative Flores, I've not spent a day in our support enforcement division, and so I'm going to ask Mr. Stecker how far back. I mean, Representative Flores is sort of wanting to know what other court records are coming in at these types of criminal non-support prosecutions.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, frequently what we do get are subpoenaed loan documents, if those are available. They'll show inconsistent statements, for example, with respect to one's income relative to the asserted position at trial versus what they may have asserted during periods of prior periods when they did not pay. That might be an example of what you're referring to. That is, if they have attested to otherwise some inconsistent evidence with what their position might be at trial. Well, we will attempt to establish that, but the problem with the statute as it now exists is that we don't necessarily always know why people don't pay. And all we're trying to do is ask that those who would be charged with this have the opportunity to demonstrate some lawful excuse. We cannot guess at all the lawful excuses, and it is just beyond the scope of what the amount of preparation that would be required for trial would include, you know, subpoenaing or seeking information from a variety of resources, some of which is protected resource. We don't even know, for example, that the person has a medical condition, nor do we know who his treating provider is. So how can we issue a subpoena to obtain the medical records to prove that that is not a lawful excuse if we don't know that information? We're just saying it's reasonable to place the burden on the defendant to come forward and give us some rationale as to why they didn't pay. And that's all the bill does.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, just reading quickly, Mr. Chairman, under ORS 161.105 sub 1A, if the offense constitutes a violation unless a culpable mental state is expressly included in the definition of the offense, that a culpable mental state is intentional conduct, knowing conduct, reckless conduct, criminal negligence, which in my opinion is not stated as a definition of this offense anymore, so we run the risk with really a quick analysis of running a Class B felony all the way down to a violation. So I think there's a deeper problem here that Representative Grohl.
What we're going to do, due to the fact we've adopted the dash ones, but we have not had the motion to move the bill. We're not going to move the bill. I would like the division to get together. We represent Ackerman and the sub-chair, Barker, and see if you can get some wording or an amendment that fixes it, please.
Certainly.
Thank you. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2976.
Troublemakers.
Culpable. I didn't know what I was doing.
House Bill 2977.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2977 establishes a law enforcement medal of honor. Within establishing that law enforcement medal of honor, it also establishes the governor's commission on the law enforcement medal of honor with members to be appointed by the governor. It also establishes a law enforcement medal of honor account and continuously appropriates money in the account to the governor. That money is really only to cover the cost of the medal itself. The commission members have the ability to raise money for that account. Members of the commission are not reimbursed for travel or other expenses incurred in the performance of their duties as members of the commission, so this wouldn't be something where they would be reaping the financial benefits. This bill did have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. However, I heard back from the Legislative Fiscal Office that this was a minimal expenditure impact and that the Ways and Means referral was not necessary. The Speaker approved my request, or the committee's request, to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and so we do not need to send it to Ways and Means.
Representative Barker had been the carrier. He's gone right now. Would someone make a motion, please?
Mr. Chair, I move then the House Bill 2977 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Olson has moved House Bill 2977 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, call the roll, please.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Please excuse.
Excuse. Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Ward?
Aye.
Vice Chairman McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye.
House Bill 2977 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I'm going to have Representative Barker and Olson as co-carriers, please. Open a work session on House Bill 3370.
Representative Pierce.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, that's not to be
intro. Oh,
first.
Do you want? Okay, do that first.
Yeah. We're going
to skip. Okay. Okay. Members of the committee, House Bill 3370. Provides that a person commits the offense of refusing to submit to a blood test or urine test if requested to do so under implied consent law. The last legislative session, the legislature enacted the crime of refusing to submit to an intoxilizer test. This simply expands the law to cover persons who, by virtue of the fact that they either cannot give a breath test because they are in the hospital or if they are showing signs of being under the influence of a controlled substance and their breath test is below a certain point, then implied consent law allows the officer to request a urine test to search for the presence of a controlled substance in the urine. This would cover those individuals as well. The fine is, or the offense is a violation, and so it is punishable by a fine only of at least $500 and not more than $1,000. And there is additional language in the statute that would talks about where those fines go.
Representative McPherson.
Chair, I had opposed this bill in the when it came to a vote in the subcommittee because I opposed the dash one amendments that were included, but in some subsequent discussions, I've determined that there was not a strong consensus in favor of those dash one amendments, and that there will be support for the bill from some who were had moved them into the had moved the dash one amendments before. For taking them back out or moving the bill without them. In fact, while Representative Barker was excused for a medical appointment, I do have his authorization to indicate that he supports the bill with the dash one amendments not included. So therefore, I move House Bill 3370 without the dash one amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson moves House Bill 3370 without the dash one to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
And then maybe, Mr. Chair, I should explain that what the dash one amendments do is they take away from the court the flexibility to waive or reduce the fines that are set here based on the particular circumstances, and it was that removal of judicial discretion that was the concern that caused me to oppose those amendments.
Who brought the amendment?
They were offered up at the work session and hearing by the couple witnesses, the Pratts, who are advocates for the bill generally and for stronger enforcement against drunk driving. But I've just subsequently discussed it with them, and I believe they're in the audience today and are not deeply concerned, at least if I could speak for them, about reversing this amendment.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I apologize for not mentioning this on my initial summary. This does have a referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee as well.
Okay. Any further discussion? Would you like to amend your movement of the bill?
Yes. Yes. Thank you very much. So that it is the motion then properly is to move House Bill 3370 without the dash one amendments onto Ways and Means in accordance with the prior referral to that committee.
Okay. Representative McPherson has moved House Bill 3370 without the dash one with the referral to Ways and Means. Any further discussion?
Representative, I will write a courtesy vote of yes to get this to Ways and Means, but I do have a concern about making this now a blood test. I've been contacted by a constituent of mine, and I haven't fully gotten convinced on their side yet, so we're still talking about this, so I just want to reserve the right to possibly pose it on the floor, but I will provide a yes vote today.
So noted. Anything further? Martin, call the roll, please.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Barker? Excused. Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 3370 moves with a referral to the Ways and Means. Open a work session of House Bill 3457.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, House Bill 3457 provides that a forfeiting agency in civil forfeiture proceedings must prove by clear and convincing evidence that real property constitutes the proceeds of prohibited conduct or instrumentality of prohibited conduct. It provides that a default judgment may be entered against fugitives in criminal and civil forfeitures and eliminates the sunset on criminal forfeiture laws. We heard about this in Coos Bay, but just to remind everyone, prior to 2000, Oregon's forfeiture laws were civil forfeiture and allowed a state agency or governmental agency to bring civil actions against criminal proceeds, the fruits and instrumentalities of criminal activity in a civil action, meaning that the seized agency had to have probable cause or a substantial objective basis to believe that the property was related to prohibited conduct. And then a person who was obviously trying to avoid the forfeiture had to show by a preponderance of the evidence that the property was not related to the prohibited conduct. In 2000, ballot measure 3 was enacted by the Oregon voters, and it was codified into statute by House Bills 2429 and 3642 during the 2001 legislative session. 2429 required the owner of properties sought to be forfeited had to be convicted of the crime, and that the property had to be instrumental in committing or facilitating that crime or be proceeds of the crime. The burden of proof was elevated to the burden of clear and convincing evidence, and the forfeiture revenue was prohibited from being spent for law enforcement purposes. Under the civil forfeiture laws before that, a lot of the times, a good portion of that money was going back to the law enforcement agencies themselves. House Bill 3642 created the new scheme of criminal forfeiture, requiring the state to allege in an indictment for a criminal act additional forfeiture counts regarding the property seized. Then the state had the burden of proof to show the property subject to the forfeiture, and that burden of proof was beyond a reasonable doubt. That House bill had a sunset provision. It will expire on July 31st of 2005. This bill would eliminate that sunset provision and leave the criminal forfeiture statutes virtually untouched, but it would also restore civil forfeiture cases. It would not allow the distribution of forfeiture proceeds to go back to the law enforcement, so that would remain consistent with ballot measure 3. And it does delineate where that money would go to causes including drug court, relief nurseries. Representative Olson actually has done the lion's share of the work on this bill, and I'm sure he will fill in any gaps that I have left at this time.
Motion on the bill? Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd make motion to move House Bill 3457 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson has moved House Bill 3457 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. It's interesting. You even got Senator Burdick to sign on to the bill.
Yes, sir.
She was a part of the work group for better part of 2 months to get it to where we are. Okay, let's have some discussion on the bill.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Ferguson.
I have a question of counsel. So if this bill were passed, then we have Measure 3 kind of overlaying this, waiting for a decision by the Oregon Supreme Court, and that could be quite some time, could be a year or two even, the way the court calendar tends to run. What would happen if this bill is enacted and then there's this continues to be this ballot measure 3 overlay, either because the court hasn't acted or if the court didn't throw out measure 3 as the had been ruled or held by the Court of Appeals?
Representative McPherson and members of the committee, my belief is that if, as long as ballot measure 3 is still good, well, it's not good law now, correct? Because it has been reversed. So the Court of Appeals has said ballot measure 3 is not good law. So if we do nothing this session, and if ballot measure 3, if the Court of Appeals is upheld by the Oregon Supreme Court, then we will have no forfeiture because the criminal forfeiture has a July 31st sunset provision in it. So if we do nothing, that's what's going to happen. If we enact this law and ballot measure 3 is upheld, meaning the Court of Appeals is reversed, then I believe the portions of civil forfeiture would be considered unconstitutional, and so it would then be, I guess, moot, for lack of a better term. I think this is essentially in anticipation of ballot measure 3 not passing. or I'm sorry, of ballot measure 3's unconstitutionality being upheld by the Supreme Court. If this bill, but if this bill passes and the civil forfeiture stuff is struck down because ballot measure 3 is upheld by the Oregon Supreme Court, then what we will have done here, at the very least, is eliminate that sunset provision on the criminal forfeiture so that there is at least some semblance of forfeiture still on the books.
I'm getting some input that's contrary on one key point, and that is what the status of ballot measure 3 is today. As a result of the Court of Appeals having held that it was not properly adopted, but that being on appeal to the Supreme Court, then I guess the question is the law today now controlled by Measure 3? And my impression is that that's the case, until the Oregon Supreme Court says ballot measure 3 is not properly adopted, and that's the challenge, is under the single subject rule, then we have that as essentially an overlay, as I see it. And so I guess what I was trying to probe is what happens to this bill, which in a number of respects is consistent with ballot measure 3, but in some respects inconsistent. Would it be that the consistent portions would take effect and the inconsistent portions would be ineffective until the Supreme Court would rule to throw Measure 3 out if they do so?
Representative McPherson and members of the committee, I believe that the answer to your question is yes, that is correct, that the inconsistent portions would not go into effect unless and until the Supreme Court upholds the Court of Appeals. I will point out that there are much, much smarter people in the room than I on this topic, including Rob Beauvais, who argued the constitutionality of ballot measure 3, and Ms. Vitalins from DOJ is also here, and so if I am answering any of these questions incorrectly, I am sure they will find their way up to the table and answer these questions.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, Rob Beauvais, I guess I'm wearing my hat now as legal counsel for the Lincoln Interagency Narcotics Team, the attorney responsible for bringing the challenge to ballot measure 3. I've been forfeiture counsel for Lincoln County and Lynch since 1992, worked on some of the original forfeiture legislation back in 1989. There are some things that maybe I could help clarify. Counsel has stated a number of things correctly. In terms of the decision from the Oregon Supreme Court, I don't think there's any chance of it taking additional years. The statistics right now as we speak are the Oregon Supreme Court, believe it or not, decides two-thirds of their cases within 6 months of oral argument and 100% of their cases within 1 year of oral argument. That's the current statistic at the Oregon Supreme Court. A lot of folks find that surprising, but actually our Oregon Supreme Court is pretty efficient at getting cases resolved and decided. As we stand here today, we oral argued the case at the very beginning of November. Statistically speaking, I am watching every Wednesday to see what their announcements are. I anticipate a decision at any moment in time. So I think the hypothetical situations we can talk about being years are extremely remote at best. In terms of the package that you're looking at today, it is a compromise. I think if we, my client would very much like you to do nothing. If you do nothing and the Oregon Supreme Court agrees with the Oregon Court of Appeals for back to status quo ante, the Oregon Court of Appeals struck down Measure 3 not because it violated the single subject rule but because it violated the separate vote requirement. Essentially, they stuffed 8 changes into a single ballot measure and asked the voters to approve all 8 things. Some of them are good things, some of them are bad things and do a lot of harm. One of the things that gets lost in a lot of the translation about Measure 3 is we often talk about drug asset forfeiture cases. We often forget about the important things the devastating impact that Measure 3 had on DUII enforcement around the state of Oregon. One of the things that had been established through the studies is that civil forfeiture, especially repeat DUII civil forfeiture ordinances, reduced recidivism among repeat habitual drunk drivers by 50%. We've lost the DUI forfeiture program statewide except in one county. I'm still holding fast in Lincoln County, but we're losing it quick here. So if Measure 3 is not over overturned at the Oregon Supreme Court, there is very little that this bill or any bill can do to overcome those provisions of Measure 3 that do harm. Those are the things that essentially will be embedded in our Constitution, and to the extent that this bill has provisions that are arguably inconsistent with that, they will be unenforceable because that will be in the Constitution. So, with that, I'd be happy to answer any other questions. I heard a few things that were kind of inconsistent with my understanding of forfeiture law, but I don't know that we want to get back into the details of that necessarily. But I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Perplexed.
Well, I'm getting, as I say, different input on the timing of the docket and before the Supreme Court, but I don't know if it's a critical issue to pursue.
Any further discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I do have further thoughts. I think the question is whether we should be going forward to act on to try to remake the landscape of civil forfeiture now, before the Supreme Court has spoken, and we're getting different thoughts about where what the timing of that decision might be, and I'm concerned that maybe it's premature for us to be pushing something that's inconsistent with ballot measure 3. And I think we also have to be mindful that there was quite a compelling policy statement made by the voters. Now, it may have mixed a number of issues together, but there were some common themes in that I think were would appear resonated with the voters, which passed by a two-thirds vote statewide. And those are things that I think we, as a policy matter, need to be mindful of when we reshape the policy in this area. So I think that it is I'm not willing to support moving this bill forward today, and would suggest as an alternative that we continue with current law by extending the sunset for another 2 years while we let this area kind of settle out further and we can get further guidance from the court. So that would be my suggestion.
Okay.
Rob, can you describe, I've heard you say it before a little bit, he referenced the will of the people. And in the campaign that passed, some of that campaign material actually was not Oregon incidents that they used to justify the bill. I'd like you to address that. And then I'd like you to address the fact that if the court does nothing and we get to the end of June or July, we would go back. But maybe you could address, I don't have a copy of it here, and we can get you one. In this measure, we did some things with the forfeiture and what it would mean to the scent teams and what it will mean to the entire program we're trying to put together with Senator Burdick, myself, Representative McPherson, and Representative Senator Beyer, as far as the meth package and having the scent teams. I mean, there's two things there. I think people need to understand if we do nothing, we're taking some things away that we need to have in place.
Mr. Chair, representatives, and you've essentially summarized it, but I'll amplify it maybe briefly. Since the passage of Measure 3, we have lost over 35% of our narcotics officers in the state of Oregon. We've lost our narcotics teams from a lot of counties directly as a result of Measure 3 and the loss of that revenue. The largest one I can think of here real recently and past summer would be the INET team, the team from Wayne County. Many other teams are struggling and suffering through this situation. It's quite regrettable that we face this situation at basically the height of our meth epidemic. As a result, the governor's meth task force, with no intervention on my own, by the way, made affirmative recommendations as to what to do with civil and criminal forfeiture, and it would have actually gone beyond this bill. It would have fully restored civil forfeiture to what we had, and it would have removed the sunset on the criminal forfeiture bill. So this is a compromise from even that position. In terms of what the voters approved, the common themes that the representative mentioned, while the Court of Appeals rejected Measure 3 because it didn't have common themes, that's exactly why they struck it down, because you can't say that because the voters like the idea of requiring a criminal conviction prior to forfeiture, which actually we were doing voluntarily anyways, is not closely connected or closely related to the idea of restricting the use of those forfeiture proceeds to support law enforcement activities. What if you support one and are against the other? This is why Measure 3 was unconstitutional, at least held by the Court of Appeals. In terms of the examples, the ballot I don't want to talk too much about the campaign, but the campaign was one-sided. There was about $500,000 spent supporting the campaign, and I think law enforcement mustered up $3,000, as I recall, to put a couple of letters out. As a result of that campaign, I think a lot of distortions were out there. The prime example, the poster child, so to speak, was actually someone, as I recall, from Southern Oregon, but they came through the federal system. It wasn't even a state of Oregon case. What the proponents of Measure 3 struggled to come up with, and I think they'd still struggle to come up with them even today, are horror stories. Poster children from the Oregon Civil Forfeiture Act that we had in place from 1989 till 2000, 11 years of forfeiture experience, they had to reach the federal system to find a poster child. So I don't know if that addresses your questions and your comments. I'm feeling like we've already compromised quite a bit in this bill. This bill, one of the things the bill does is it restricts the ability to use any forfeiture proceeds for law enforcement wages. That's something we could do for overtime and other sorts of things prior to Measure 3 and essentially giving up that piece of it. The other important things that this bill would do would be to fund some important things that the Governor's Meth Task Force identified as important and desperately in need of funding, including drug courts, including the relief nurseries. So we're not dedicating back all the revenues to law enforcement. We are dedicating a portion of it so we can try to do some of the restoration of the important programs such as the DUI forfeiture ordinances and the narcotics teams that we've lost throughout the state of Oregon. So I don't know if that answers your questions, Mr. Chair, but that's my best attempt to summarize real quickly.
Any further discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm just going to chime in here. I think there's, if you really do take a look at when Measure 3 came on board and to when we started really experiencing some serious drug trafficking problems in our state, the two are connected. And this is a great tool for us to get back for law enforcement, but also to protect the schools as well as families and our communities, and especially a tool for law enforcement.
Okay, Representative Garrard.
Mr. Chair, and that six members of this committee are co-sponsors of this bill, I would think perhaps a vote is appropriate.
We will go there.
Let me just offer up some thoughts here. I'm deeply appreciative of the work that particularly Representative Olson has done in trying to crafting this legislation, and I raise questions about it because I'm concerned about where we are in the timing of considering where the challenge to Measure 3 is and whether this is the right timing to be going forward with this package. I am quite concerned about the interaction between these issues on civil forfeiture and our effective response to the meth epidemic. And I am, as the chair's observed, part of a work group that's in that area. I was not aware that we were, in effect, banking on a return to civil forfeiture in order to be able to fund that effort, and I need to consider that further. So I'm open to further input on these issues, but I think at this point I'm not comfortable moving the bill forward, and will be a no vote today, but I think it should be, obviously I think there's sufficient support because of the co-sponsorship to move it forward and make that should happen, but I want to register a note of concern in order to be able to work on these issues further.
Okay, thank you. Any further? Call the vote.
Representative Ackerman?
No.
Representative Barker? Excuse. Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Vice Chair McPherson?
No.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 3457 moves to the floor with a due pass, and Representative Olson, you'll be the carrier. What did that take us? 2 hours? 20 minutes. Anything further from the committee?
Well, Tuesday morning, and then I'm going to remind everyone.
Okay, we're going to have full Tuesday morning at 8:30. Make sure that everyone's here, please. We're adjourned.